Chapter 6. It was nearly an hour after the 2:45 had arrived at its destination that a slower, shabbier train crawled in and deposited Ronnie Fish on the platform of the little station of Market Blandings. The festivities connected with his cousin George's wedding and the intricacies of a railway journey across the breadth of England had combined to prevent an earlier return. He was tired but happy. The glow of sentiment which warms young men in love when they watch other people getting married still lingered. Mendelssohn's well-known march was on his lips as he gave up his ticket, and it was with a perceptible effort that he checked himself from saying to the driver of the station cab, "Wilt thou, Robinson, take this Ronald to Blandings Castle?" Even when he reached his destination and found the hands of the grandfather clock in the hall pointing to 7:50, his exuberance did not desert him. It was his pride that he could shave, bathe, and dress, always provided that nothing went wrong with the tie, in 9 1/4 minutes. Tonight, all was well. The black strip of crepe de chine assumed the perfect butterfly shape of its own volition, and at 8 precisely, he was standing in the combination drawing room and picture gallery in which Blandings Castle was wont to assemble long before the evening meal. He was surprised to find himself alone. And it was not long before surprise gave way to a stronger emotion. For some minutes he wandered to and fro, gazing at the portraits of his ancestors on the walls. But to a man who has just come from a long and dusty train journey, ancestral portraits are a poor substitute for the old familiar juice. He pressed the bell, and presently Beach the butler appeared.
"Oh, hello, Beach. I say, Beach, what about the cocktails?"
The butler seemed surprised. "I was planning to serve them when the guests arrived, Mr. Ronald."
"Guests? There aren't people coming to dinner, are there?"
"Yes, sir. We shall sit down 24.
"Good Lord, a binge?"
"Yes, sir.
I must go and put on a white tie."
"There's plenty of time, Mr. Ronald. Dinner will not be served till 9 o'clock. Perhaps you would prefer me to bring you an aperitif in advance of the formal cocktails."
"I certainly would. I'm dying by inches."
"I will attend to the matter immediately." The butler of Blandings Castle was not a man who, when he said immediately, meant somewhere in the distant future. Like a heavyweight gin, stirred to activity by the rubbing of a lamp, he vanished and reappeared. And it was only a few minutes later that Ronnie was blossoming like a flower in the gentle rain of summer and finding himself disposed for leisurely chat.
24,
he said.
"Golly, we're going gay. Who's coming?"
The butler's eyes took on a glaze similar to that seen in those of policemen giving evidence. "His Lordship the Bishop of Poole, Sir Herbert and Lady Musker, Sir Gregory Parslow Parslow."
"What?"
"Yes, sir."
"Who invited him?"
"Her ladyship, I should imagine, sir."
"And he's coming? Well, I suppose he knows his own business," said Ronnie dubiously. "Better keep a close eye on Uncle Clarence, Beach. If you see him toying with a knife, remove it."
"Very good, sir."
"Who else?"
"Colonel and Mrs. Mollevera and daughter, the Honourable Major and Lady Augusta Lindsay Todd and niece."
"All right, you needn't go on. I get the general idea. 18 local nibs plus the gang of 6 in residence."
"8. Mr. Ronald."
"8?
His Lordship, Her Ladyship, Mr. Galahad, yourself, Miss Brown, Mr. The butler's voice shook a little. "Pilbeam?"
"Exactly. 6, you old ass."
"There is also Mr. Bodkin, sir."
"Bodkin?"
"Sir Gregory Parslow's nephew, Mr. Ronald, Mr. Montague Bodkin. You may recall him as somewhat frequent visitor to the castle during his school days."
"Of course I remember old Monty, but you've got muddled. You've counted him in among the resident patients, when he's really one of the outside crowd."
No, sir. Mr. Bodkin is assuming Mr. Carmody's duties as his lordship's secretary."
"Not really?"
"Yes, sir. I understand the appointment was ratified 2 days ago."
"But that's odd. What does Monty want? Sweating as a secretary. He's got about 15,000 a year of his own."
"Indeed, sir."
"Well, he had. Somehow or other, we've not happened to run into each other much these last 2 years. Do you think he's lost it?"
"Very possibly, sir. A great many people have become fiscally crippled of late."
"Rummy," said Ronnie.
Then speculation on this mystery was borne away on a flood of sober pride. With a pardonable feeling of smugness, Ronnie Fish realized that his soul had achieved such heights of nobility that the prospect of a Monty Bodkin buzzing about the castle premises in daily contact with Sue was causing him no pang of apprehension or jealousy. Not so very long ago, such a thought would have been a dagger in his bosom. It was just the Monty type of chap, tall, lissom, good-looking, and not pink, that he had always feared. And now he could contemplate his coming without a tremor. Pretty good, felt Ronnie.
Well, come along with your 8, he said. There's only 7 so far.
The butler coughed. I was assuming, Mr. Ronald, that you were aware that her ladyship, your mother, arrived this evening on the 2:45 train.
What?
Yes, sir.
Good Lord!
Beach regarded him solicitously, but did not develop the theme. He had a nice sense of the proprieties. Between himself and this young man, there had existed for 18 years a warm friendship. Ronnie, as a child, had played bears in his pantry. Ronnie, as a boy, had gone fishing with him on the lake. Ronnie, as a freshman at Cambridge, had borrowed 5-pound notes from him to see him through to his next allowance. Ronnie, grown to man's estate, had given him many a sound tip on the races, from which his savings bank account had profited largely. He knew the last detail of Ronnie's romance, sympathized with his aims and objects, was aware that an interview of extreme delicacy faced him, and had they been sitting in his pantry now, would not have hesitated to offer sympathy and advice. But because this was the drawing-room, his lips were sealed. A mere professional gesture was all he could allow himself. Another cocktail, Mr. Ronald.
Thanks.
Ronnie, sipping thoughtfully, found his equanimity returning. For a moment he could not deny it. There had been a slight sinking of the heart, but now he was telling himself that his mother had always been a cheery soul, one of the best, and that there was no earthly reason to suppose that she was likely to make any serious trouble now. True, there might be a little stiffness at first, but that would soon wear off.
Where is she, Beach?
In the garden room, Mr. Ronald.
I ought to go there, I suppose. And yet... No, said Ronnie, on second thoughts. Might be a little rash, what? There she would be with her hairbrush handy, and the temptation to put me across her knee, and... No, I think you'd better send a maid or someone to inform her that I await her here.
I will do so immediately, Mr. Ronald. With a quiver of the left eyebrow intended to indicate that, had such a thing been possible to a man in his position, he would gladly have remained and lent moral support, the butler left the room. And presently the door reopened, and Lady Julia Fish came sailing in. Ronnie straightened his tie, pulled down his waistcoat, and advanced to meet her. The emotions of a young man on encountering his maternal parent, when in the interval since they last saw one another he has announced his betrothal to a member of the chorus, are necessarily mixed. Filial love cannot but be tempered with apprehension. On the whole, however, Ronnie was feeling reasonably debonair. He and his mother had laughed together at a good many things in their time, and he was optimistic enough to hope that with a little adroitness on his part, the coming scene could be kept on the lighter plane. As he had said to Sue, Lady Julia Fish was not Lady Constance Keeble. Nevertheless, as he kissed her, he was aware of something of the feeling which he had had in his boxing days when shaking hands with an unpleasant-looking opponent.
Hello, Mother.
Well, Ronnie?
Here you are, what?
Yes.
Nice journey?
Quite.
Not rough, crossing over?
Not at all.
Good, said Ronnie. Good.
He began to feel easier.
Well, he proceeded chattily, we got old George off all right.
George?
Cousin George. I've just been best manning at his wedding.
Ah, yes, I had forgotten. It was today, was it not?
That's right. I only got back 30 minutes ago.
Did everything go off well?
Splendidly. Not a hitch.
Family pleased, I suppose?
Oh, delighted.
They would be, wouldn't they?
Seeing that George was marrying a girl of excellent position with 10,000 a year of her own. said Ronnie.
Yes, said Lady Julia. You'd better say...
There was a pause. Ronnie, who had just straightened his tie again, pulled it crooked and began straightening it once more. Lady Julia watched these manifestations of unrest with a grim blue stare.
Ronnie, looking up and meeting it, diverted his gaze towards a portrait of the second Earl, which hung on the wall beside him.
"Amazing beards those blokes used to wear," he said nonchalantly.
"I wonder you can look your ancestors in the face."
"I can't, as a matter of fact. They're an ugly crowd. The only decent one is Daredevil Dick Threepwood, who married the actress."
"You would bring up Daredevil Dick, wouldn't you?"
"That's right, Mother. Let's see the old smile."
"I'm not smiling. What you observed was a twitch of pain."
"Really, Ronnie, you ought to be certified." "Now, Mother..."
"Ronnie," said Lady Julia, "if you dare to lift up your finger and say, tweet, tweet, shush, shush, come, come, I'll hit you. It's no good grinning in that sickening way. It simply confirms my opinion that you are a raving lunatic, an utter imbecile, and that you ought to have been placed under restraint years ago."
"Oh, dash it! It's no good saying, oh, dash it. Well, I do say, oh, dash it. Be reasonable. Naturally, I don't expect you to start dancing round and string roses out of a hat, but you might preserve the decencies of debate. Highly offensive, that last crack."
Lady Julia sighed. "Why do all you young fools want to marry chorus girls?"
"Read any good books lately, Mother?"
said Ronnie pacifically. Lady Julia refused to be diverted. "It's too amazing. It's a disease. It really is. Just like measles or whooping cough. All young men apparently have to go through it. It seems only the other day that my poor father was shipping your Uncle Galahad off to Africa to ensure a cure."
"I'll tell you something interesting about that, Mother. The girl Uncle Gally was in love with..."
"I was a child at the time, but I can recall it so distinctly. Father thumping tables, Mother weeping, and all that rather charming old-world atmosphere of family curses. And now it's you. Well, well, one can only thank goodness that it never seems to last long. The fever takes its course and the patient recovers. Ronnie, my poor half-wit, you can't really be serious about this."
"Serious?
But, Ronnie, really, a chorus girl.
There's a lot to be said for chorus girls."
"Not in my presence. I couldn't bear it. It's so callow of you, my dear boy. If this had happened when you were at Eton, I wouldn't have said a word. But when you're grown up and are supposed to have some sense, look at the men who marry chorus girls. A race apart. Young Datchet, that awful old Bellinger."
"Ah, but you're overlooking something, my dear old parent. There are chorus girls and chorus girls."
"This is your kind heart speaking."
"And when you get one like Sue..."
"No, Ronnie, it's nice of you to try to cheer me up, but it can't be done. I regard the entire personnel of the ensemble of our musical comedy theatres as, if you will forgive me being Victorian for a moment, painted hussies."
"They've got to paint."
"Well, they needn't huss. And they needn't ensnare my son."
"I'm not sure I like that word, ensnare, much."
"You probably won't much like any of the words you're going to get from me tonight. Honestly, Ronnie, I know it hurts your head to think, but try to just for a moment. It isn't simply a question of class. It's the whole thing, the different viewpoint, the different standards, everything. I take it that your idea when you marry is to settle down and lead a normal sort of life. And how are you going to do that with a chorus girl? How are you going to trust a woman of that sort of upbringing, who's lived on excitement ever since she was old enough to kick her beastly legs up in front of an audience and sees nothing wrong in going off having affairs with every man that takes her fancy? That sort of girl would be sneaking off round the corner the moment your back was turned."
"Not Sue."
"Yes, Sue." Ronnie smiled indulgently.
"Wait till you meet her."
"I have met her, thanks." "Maud?" "She was in the train and introduced herself."
"But what was she doing in the train?"
"Returning here from London."
"I didn't know she'd gone up to London."
"So I imagine," said Lady Julia. Not many minutes had passed since Ronnie Fish had been urging his mother to smile. With these words she had done so, but the fulfilment of his wish brought him no pleasure. The pink of his face deepened. There had come a lightness about his mouth. He changed his mind about the desirability of keeping the scene light.
"You mind if I just get this straight?"
he said coldly.
"A moment ago you were talking about girls who ran off and had affairs, and now you tell me you've met Sue."
"Exactly."
"Then you had Sue in mind?"
"Exactly." Ronnie laughed unpleasantly.
"On the strength, apparently, of her having been up to London for the day, to do some shopping or something, I suppose. I wouldn't call this your ripest form, Mother.
On the strength, if you really wish to know, of seeing her and young Monty Bodkin lunching together at the Barclay and finding them together on the train.
Monty Bodkin?
Where they had the effrontery to pretend they had never met before.
She was lunching with Monty?
Lunching with Monty and ogling Monty and holding hands with Monty. Oh, for heaven's sake, Ronnie, do use a little intelligence. Can't you see this girl is just like the rest of them? If you can't, you really must be a borderline case. Young Bodkin came here today to be your uncle's secretary. 2 days ago, he had some sort of employment with the Mammoth Publishing Company. He told me on the train that he had resigned. Why did he resign? And why is he coming here? Obviously because this girl wanted him here and put him up to it. And directly she hears it's settled, she takes advantage of your being away to sneak up to London and talk things over with him. If there was nothing underhand going on, why should they have pretended that they were perfect strangers? No, as you said just now, I am not dancing round and strewing roses out of a hat. She broke off. The door had opened. Lady Constance Keeble came in. In the doorway, Lady Constance paused. She looked from one to the other with speculation in her eyes. She was a veteran of too many fine old crusted family rows, not to be able to detect a strained atmosphere when she saw one. Her sister Julia was clenching and unclenching her hands. Her nephew Ronald was staring straight before him, red-eyed. A thrill ran through Lady Constance, such as causes the war horse to start at the sound of the bugle. It was possible, of course, that this was a private fight, but her battling instinct urged her to get into it. But there was in Lady Constance Keeble an instinct even stronger than that of battle, and that was the one which impelled her to act as critic of the sartorial deficiencies of her nearest and dearest. Years of association with her brother Clarence, who, if you took your eye off him for a second, was apt to come down to dinner in flannel trousers and old shooting jacket, had made this action almost automatic with the Chatelaine of Blandings. So now, eager for the fray, it was as the critic, rather than as the warrior queen, that she spoke.
"My dear Ronald, that tie!"
Ronnie Fish gazed at her lingeringly. It needed, he felt, but this. Poison was running through his veins. His world was rocking. Green-eyed devils were shrieking mockery in his ears, and along came blasted aunts, babbling of ties. It was as if somebody touched Othello on the arm as he poised the pillow and criticized the cut of his doublet.
"Don't you know we have a dinner party tonight? Go and put on a white tie at once."
Even in his misery, the injustice of the thing cut Ronnie to the quick. Did his aunt suppose him ignorant of the merest decencies of life? Naturally, if he had known before he started dressing that there was a big binge on, he would have assumed the correct costume of the English gentleman for formal occasions. But considering that he'd been told only about 2 minutes ago,
"And a tailcoat!"
It was the end. If this woman's words had any meaning at all, it was that she considered him capable of wearing a white tie with a dinner jacket. Until this moment, he'd been intending to speak. The thing had now passed beyond speech. Directing at Lady Constance a look which no young man ought to have directed at an aunt, he strode silently from the room. Lady Constance stood listening to the echoes of a well-slammed door.
"Ronald seems upset," she observed.
"It runs in the family," said Lady Julia.
"What was the trouble?"
"I've just been telling him that he is off his head."
"I quite agree with you.
And I should like now," said Lady Julia, "to apply the same remark to you." She was breathing quickly. The china blue of her eyes had an enameled look. It was 35 years since she had scratched Lady Constance's face, but she seemed so much in the vein for some such demonstration that the latter involuntarily drew back.
"Really, Julia? What do you mean, Constance, by inviting that girl to Blandings?"
"I did nothing of the sort."
"You didn't invite her?"
"Certainly not.
She popped up out of a trap, eh?"
Lady Constance emitted that sniff of hers which came so near to being a snort.
"She wormed her way into the place under false pretenses, which amounts to the same thing. You remember that Miss Schoonmacker, the American girl you met at Biarritz and wrote to me about? You gave me the impression that you hoped there might eventually be something between her and Ronald.
I really can't understand what you're talking about. Why need we discuss Myra Schoonmaker? I'm trying to explain to you how this Brun girl comes to be at the castle. About 10 days ago, I was in London, and I met Ronald in his car with a girl, and he introduced her to me as Miss Schoonmaker. I had no means of checking his statement. It never occurred to me to doubt it. I assumed that she really was Miss Schoonmaker, and naturally invited her to the castle. She arrived, and she had not been here 24 hours when we discovered that she was not Miss Schoonmaker at all, but this chorus girl of Ronald's. Presumably they'd planned the thing between them in order to get her here. And when you found out she was an impostor, you asked her to stay on. I see. Lady Constance flushed brightly. I was compelled to allow her to stay on. Why? Because... Oh, Clarence, said Lady Constance, with the exasperation which the sudden spectacle of the head of the family so often aroused in her. The 9th Earl had selected this tense moment to potter into the room. Eh? He said. Go away! Yes, said Lord Emsworth. Lovely. As so frequently happened with him, he was in a gentle trance. He wandered to the piano, extended a long, lean finger, and stabbed absently at one of the treble notes. The sharp, tinny sound seemed to affect his sister Constance like a pin in the leg. Clarence! Eh? Don't do that! God bless my soul, said Lord Emsworth querulously. He turned from the piano, and Lady Constance was enabled to see him steadily and see him whole. The sight caused her to utter a stricken cry. Clarence! Eh? What? What is that thing on your shirt front? The 9th Earl squinted down. It's a paper fastener. One of those brass things you fasten papers with. I lost my stud. You must have more than one stud. Here's another, up here. Have you only 2 studs? 3, said Lord Emsworth a little proudly. For the front of the shirt, 3. Dashed inconvenient things. The heads come off. You screw them off, and then you put them in, and then you screw them on. We'll go straight up to your room and screw on the spare one. It was not often that Lord Emsworth found himself in the position of being able to score a debating point against his sister Constance. The fact that he was about to do so now filled him with a justifiable complacency. It seemed to lend to his manner a strange, quiet dignity. I can't, he said. I swallowed it. Lady Constance was not the woman to despair for long. A short, sharp spasm of agony, and she'd seen the way. "Wait here," she said. "Mr. Bodkin is sure to have dozens of spare studs. If you dare to move till I come back..." She hurried from the room. "Connie fusses so," said Lord Emsworth equably. He pottered back to the piano. "Clarence," said Lady Julia. "Eh? Leave that piano alone. Pull yourself together. Try to concentrate and tell me about this Miss Brown." "Miss who?" "Miss Brown." "Never heard of her," said Lord Emsworth brightly, striking a D-flat. "Don't jibber, Clarence. Miss Brown." "Oh, Miss Brown. Yes. Yes, of course. Yes. Miss Brown, to be sure. Yes. Nice girl. She's going to marry Ronald." "Is she? That's a debatable point." "Oh, yes. It's all settled. I'm giving the boy his money, and he's going into the motor business, and they're going to get married. I want to know how all this happened. How is it that this chorus girl..." "You're quite right," said Lord Emsworth cordially. "I told Connie she was wrong, but she wouldn't believe me. A chorus girl is quite different from a ballet girl. Galahad assures me of this. If you will kindly let me finish..." "By all means, by all means. You were saying..." "I was asking you how it has come about that everyone in this madhouse appears to have accepted it as quite natural and satisfactory that Ronnie should be marrying a girl like that. She seems to be an honoured guest at the castle, and yet, apart from anything else, she came here under a false name." "Odd that," said Lord Emsworth. "She told us her name was Schoolbred, and it turned out that she was quite wrong. It wasn't Schoolbred at all.
silly mistake to make.
And when that turned out, may I ask why you didn't turn her out?
Why, we couldn't, of course.
Why not?
Well, naturally we couldn't. Galahad wouldn't have liked it.
Galahad?
That's right. Galahad.
Lady Julia threw up her arms in a passionate gesture.
Is everybody crazy? She cried.
Lady Constance came hurrying back into the room.
Clarence! You all keep saying Clarence, said Lord Emsworth peevishly. Clarence! Clarence! One would think I was a Pekingese or something. Well, what is it now?
Listen, Clarence, said Lady Constance, speaking in a clear, even voice, and follow me carefully. Mr. Bodkin is in the north room. You know where the north room is? On the first floor, down the passage to the right of the landing. You know which your right hand is? Very well. Then go immediately to the north room, and there you will find Mr. Bodkin. He has studs, and will fit them into your shirt.
I'm dashed if I'm going to have my secretary dressing me like a nursemaid.
If you think that with 16 people coming to dinner, I'm going to trust you to put in studs for yourself.
Oh, all right, said Lord Emsworth. All right, all right, all right. Lot of fuss for nothing.
The door closed. Lady Julia came out of the frozen coma into which her brother's words had thrown her.
Constance? Well, just before you came in, Clarence told me that the reason why this brown girl was allowed to stay on at the castle was that Galahad wished it.
Yes?
And we must all respect Galahad's wishes, must we not?
I don't suppose, said Lady Julia, mastering her complex emotions with a strong effort, that there are 40 million people in England who think more highly of Galahad than I do. Tell me, she went on, with strained politeness,
if it is not troubling you too much, how exactly does he come into the thing at all? Why Galahad? Why not Beech, or Vools, or the boy who cleans the knives and boots? What earthly business is it of Galahad's?
Lady Constance was not by nature a patient woman, but she could make allowances for a mother's grief.
I know how you must be feeling, Julia, and you can't be more upset about it than I am. Galahad, unfortunately, is in a position to dictate.
I cannot conceive of any possible position Galahad would be in which would permit him to dictate to me, but no doubt you will explain what you mean later. What I would like to know first is why he wants to dictate. What is this girl to him that he should apparently have constituted himself a sort of guardian angel to her? To explain that, I must ask you to throw your mind back.
Better not start me throwing things.
Do you remember, years ago, Galahad getting entangled with a woman named Henderson? A music hall singer?
Certainly.
Well, this girl is her daughter.
Lady Julia was silent for a moment. I see.
Galahad's daughter, too?
I believe not. But that explains his interest in her.
Possibly. Yes, no doubt it does. Sentiment is the last thing of which I would have suspected Galahad. But if the old love has lingered down the years, I suppose we must accept it. All right. Very touching, no doubt. But it still leaves unexplained the mystery of why everybody here seems to be treating Galahad as if his word was law. You said he was in a position to dictate.
Why?
I was coming to that. The whole thing, you see, turns on whether Clarence lets Ronald have his money or not. If he does, Ronald can defy us all. Without it, he is helpless. And in ordinary circumstances, you and I know that we could easily reason with Clarence and make him do the sensible thing and refuse to release the money.
Well,
Galahad was clever enough to see that, too. So he made a bargain. You know those abominable reminiscences he'd been writing? He said that if Ronald was given his money, he would suppress them.
What?
Suppress them, not publish them. Is that what you meant when you said that he was in a position to dictate?
Yes, it's sheer blackmail, of course, but there's nothing to be done.
Lady Julia was staring, bewildered. She flung her hands up to her carefully coiffured hair, seemed to realize at the last moment that a touch would ruin it, and lowered them again.
Am I mad? She cried. Or is everybody else? You seriously mean that I'm supposed to acquiesce in my son's ruining his life simply in order to keep Galahad from publishing his reminiscences? But, Julia, you don't know what they're like. Think of the life Galahad led as a young man. He seems to have known everybody in England who is looked up to and respected today, and to have shared the most disgraceful escapades with them. One case alone, for example, Sir Gregory Parslow. I've not read the thing, of course, but he tells me that there is a story in Galahad's book about himself when he was a young man in London, something about some prawns, I don't know what, which would make him the laughingstock of the county. The book is full of that kind of story, and every story about somebody who is looked on today as a model of propriety. If it is published, it will ruin the reputations of half the best people in England.
Lady Julia laughed shortly. I'm afraid I don't share your reverence for the feelings of the British aristocracy, Connie. I agree that Galahad probably knows the shady secrets of two-thirds of the peerage, but I don't feel your shrinking horror at the thought of the public reading them in print. I haven't the slightest objection in the world to Galahad throwing bombshells. At any rate, whatever the effect of his literary efforts on the peace of mind of the governing classes, I certainly do not intend to buy him off at the price of having Ronnie marrying any Miss Browns.
You don't mean that you're going to try to stop this marriage?
I most certainly am.
But, Julia, this book of Galahad's, it will alienate every friend we've got. They will say we ought to have stopped him. You don't know.
I know this. That Galahad can publish reminiscences till he is blue in the face, but I am not going to have my son making a fool of himself and doing something he'll regret for the rest of his life. And now, if you'll excuse me, Connie, I propose to take a short stroll on the terrace in the faint hope of cooling off. I feel so incandescent that I'm apt to burst into spontaneous flame at any moment, like dry tinder. With which words, Lady Julia Fish took her departure through the French windows. And Lady Constance, having remained for some moments in anguished thought, moved to the fireplace and rang the bell. Beach appeared.
Beach, said Lady Constance, please telephone at once to Sir Gregory Parslow at Matchingham. Tell him I must see him immediately. Say it is of the utmost importance. Ask him to hurry over so as to get here before people begin to arrive. And when he comes, show him into the library.
Very good, my lady. The butler spoke with his official calm, but inwardly he was profoundly stirred. He was not a nimble-minded man, but he could put two and two together, and it seemed to him that in some mysterious way, beyond the power of his intellect to grasp, all these alarms and excursions must be connected with the love story of his old friend Mr. Ronald and his new, but very highly esteemed friend, Sue Brown. He had left Mr. Ronald with his mother. Then Lady Constance had gone in. A short while later, Mr. Ronald had come out and gone rushing upstairs with all the appearance of an overwrought soul. And now, here was Lady Constance, after a conversation with Lady Julia, ringing bells and sending urgent telephone messages. It must mean something. If Beach had been Monty Bodkin, he would have said that there were wheels within wheels. Heaving gently, like a seaweed-covered sea, he withdrew to carry out his instructions. The butler's telephone message found Sir Gregory Parslow enjoying a restful cigarette in his bedroom. He had completed his toilet some little time before, but, being an experienced diner out, and knowing how sticky that anti-prandial vigil in somebody else's drawing-room can be, he had not intended to set out for Blandings Castle for another 20 minutes or so. Like so many elderly, self-indulgent bachelors, he was inclined to shirk life's grimmer side. But the information that Lady Constance Keeble wished to have urgent speech with him had him galloping down the stairs and lumbering into his car in what, for a man of his build, was practically tantamount to a trice. It must, he felt, be those infernal reminiscences that she wanted to see him about. And, feeling nervous and apprehensive, he told the chauffeur to drive like the devil. In the past 2 weeks, Sir Gregory Parslow Parslow of Matchingham Hall, 7th Baronet of his line, had run the gamut of the emotions. He had plumbed the depths of horror on learning that his old companion, the Honourable Galahad Threepwood, was planning to publish the story of his life. He'd soared to dizzy heights of relief on learning that he had decided not to do so. But from that relief, there had been a reaction. What, he had asked himself, was to prevent the old pest changing his mind again? And this telephone call seemed to suggest that he might have done so. Of all the grey-haired pillars of society who had winced and cried aloud at the news that the Honourable Galahad was about to unlock the doors of memory, it was probably Sir Gregory Parslow who had winced most and cried loudest. His position was so particularly vulnerable. He had political ambitions, and was indeed on the eve of being accepted by the local Unionist Committee as the party's candidate for the forthcoming by-election in the Bridgford and Chifley parliamentary division of Shropshire. And no one knew better than himself that Unionist committees look askance at men with pasts. Small wonder, then, that Sir Gregory Parslow writhed in his car, and, clumping up the stairs of Blandings Castle to the library and Beech's Wake, sank into a chair and sat gazing at Lady Constance with apprehension on every feature of his massive face. Years of good living had given Sir Gregory something of the look of a buck of the Regency days. He resembled now a Regency buck about to embark on a difficult interview with the family lawyer. Lady Constance made no humane attempt to break the bad news gently. She was far too agitated for that. Sir Gregory got it like a pail of water in the face, and sat spluttering as if it actually had been water she had poured over him. "What shall we do?" lamented Lady Constance. "I know Julia so well. She's entirely self-centred. So long as she can get what she wants, other people don't count. Julia's like that, and always has been. She will stop this marriage. I don't know how, but she will do it. And if the marriage is broken off, Galahad will have no reason for suppressing his abominable book. The manuscript will go to the publishers next day. What did you say?" Sir Gregory had not spoken. He'd merely uttered a wordless sound halfway between a grunt and a groan. "Have you nothing to suggest?" said Lady Constance. Before the baronet could reply, if he would have replied, there was an interruption. The door of the library opened, and a head inserted itself. It was a small, brilliantined head, the eyes beneath the narrow forehead furtive, the moustache below the perky nose, a nasty little moustache. Having smiled weakly, it withdrew. It was a desire for solitude that had brought P. Frobisher Pilbeam to the library. A few moments before, he had been in the drawing-room and had found its atmosphere oppressive. Solid county gentlemen and their wives had begun to arrive, and the sense of being an alien in a community where everybody seemed extraordinarily intimate with everybody else had weighed upon him, inducing red ears and a general sensation of elephantiasis about the hands and feet. Taking advantage, therefore, of the fact that the lady with the weather-beaten face who just asked him what pack he hunted with had had her attention diverted elsewhere, he'd stolen down to the library to be alone. And the first thing he saw there was Lady Constance Keeble. So, as we say, Percy Pilbeam smiled weakly and withdrew. The actual time covered by his appearance and disappearance was not more than 2 or 3 seconds, but it had been enough for Lady Constance Keeble to give him one of the celebrated Keeble looks. Turning from this task, and lowering the raised eyebrow and uncurling the curled lip, she was astonished to observe that Sir Gregory Parslow was staring at the closed door with the aspect of one who had just seen a beautiful vision.
"What? What? What?"
"I beg your pardon," said Lady Constance, perplexed.
"Good heavens! Was that Pilbeam?"
Lady Constance was shocked.
"Do you know Mr. Pilbeam?"
she asked, in a tone which suggested that she would have expected something better than this from the seventh holder of a proud title. Sir Gregory was not a man of the build that leaps from chairs, but he had levered himself out of the one he sat in with an animation that almost made the thing amount to a leap.
"Know him? Why, he's in the castle because I know him. I engaged him to steal that infernal manuscript of your brother's."
"What?"
"Certainly. A week or so ago, Emsworth called one morning with Threepwood to see me, and accused me of having stolen that dashed pig of his. And when I told him I knew nothing about it, Threepwood got nasty and said he was going to make a special effort to remember all the discreditable things that had ever happened to me as a young man and put them in his book. So I ran up to London next day and went to see this fella, Pilbeam. He'd acted for me before in a certain rather delicate matter, and found that Emsworth had asked him to come here to investigate the theft of his pig. And I offered him £500 if, when he was in the castle, he would steal the manuscript."
"Good gracious!
And then you told me the pig had been found, and Threepwood was going to suppress the book, so I naturally assumed that the chap would have gone back to London. Why? If he's still here, the whole thing's simple. He must go ahead as originally planned and get hold of that manuscript and hand it over to us, and we'll destroy it. Then it won't matter if this marriage you speak of takes place or not.
He paused. Animation gave place to concern.
But suppose there are more copies than one?
There aren't.
You're sure? He may have had it typed.
No, I know he has not. He had never really finished the horrible thing. He keeps it in his desk and takes it out and adds bits to it.
Then we're all right.
If Mr. Bilbeam can get possession of the manuscript.
Oh, he'll do that. You can rely on him. There isn't a smarter young fella in London at that sort of thing. Why, he got hold of some letters of mine. That's neither here nor there. I can assure you that if you can engage Bilbeam to steal compromising papers, you'll have them in the course of a day or two. It's what he's best at. You say Threepwood keeps the thing in a desk. Desks are nothing to Bilbeam. Those letters of mine, to which I alluded just now, those letters, perfectly innocent, you understand, but a wrong construction might have been placed upon one or two passages of them, had they been published as the girl, as their recipient, had threatened. To cut a long story short, to secure them, Bilbeam had to pretend to be the man come to inspect the gas meter and break into a safe. This'll be child's play to him. If you will excuse me, I will go and find him at once. We must put the matter in hand without delay. What a pity he popped off like that. We could have had everything arranged by now.
Sir Gregory hurried from the room, baying on the scent like one of his own hounds, and Lady Constance, drawing a deep breath, leant back in her chair and closed her eyes. After all that had passed in the last 20 minutes, she felt the need to relax. On her face, as she sat, there might have been observed not merely relief, but a sort of awed look, as of one who contemplates the inscrutable workings of Providence. Providence, she now perceived, did not put even Pilbeams into the world without a purpose.